Menards is the ultimate home improvement destination in the Midwest. Since 1958, we've been supplying you with everything from hardware to automotive needs. We believe in helping you save big money on every project, big or small. From top-of-the-line tools to plumbing supplies, paint, and appliances, we've got you covered. We thank you for making Menards a part of your year. From our family to yours, have a safe and happy new year.
Save big money at Menards.
Felcia, a thousand welcomes to the Village Oak Tree for April 3rd, 2024. My name is Terrence O'Donnell. I'm returning again to your village this week with another interview. Today, I'll be interviewing Mr. Eugene Williams, Jr., a noted author and educator, who's agreed to talk to me today about some of the fuss over DEI, or the lack of it in some schools, and how that and other divisive government programs, or lack thereof, maybe having on minority or economically challenged students. So with that, let me introduce Mr. Eugene Williams here. And we'll bring this up. And all right, Mr. Williams, how are you?
I am well. How are you doing, sir?
I'm doing good. So as I mentioned in the earlier conversations, I've got a couple of my own children who are educators. One I talked to last week, and because she lost her DEI program down where she's at. Now, because she works where she does, she asked me not to mention her, where she works, who she is. She's very worried about her job down there. So I said, I'll leave it at that. I just say that I talked to her and, you know, being things the way they are in this country, I'll leave it at that. But you know, as I said, that we are in a new atmosphere here in the last year or so, with all this, what I call right-wing rhetoric about woke business and whatever terminology they want to use. And they're, you know, there's the states, not the federal government, but the states are divesting funding for these DEI programs. So, you know, my questions around it is in, you know, from your perspective, you know, how that affects students that you come across. So my first question, you know, as I said, I talked to her and she's doing workarounds down there where she works to keep the federal funding going for the DEI. And, you know, she says they're according what the way they're doing it is they're telling the federal government that we have DEI programs, but they're telling the state where she's at that, no, we're not doing DEI. We're calling it something else just to keep things, you know, keep the local police down there from invading the campus. I mean,
understood.
You know, the big thing is from what you've seen here recently, do you see that affecting any other schools that you know of?
Well, I can tell you that they are removed. First of all, thank you for having me, number one. It's always great to be here with you. I'm glad that we're here to talk about this topic. What I can tell you as a recently retired public high school administrator, I've been in education, public education for 27 years, 10 years in the classroom, 17 years as an administrator. Just retired this past June 2023. So I just got out of it. I can tell you that DEI departments are either closing or shrinking or changing their focus in a lot of school systems now throughout the country. Now, you talked about, in your introduction, you talked about how the climate has changed in recent times because of DEI. I would maintain the climate has not changed. As we were talking before, the climate ebbs and flows. If you're a person of color, you've been here before. We've seen this before, whether it be George Wallace in the 60s, whether it Ronald Reagan in the 80s, whether it be busing, whatever it is. So while the rest of the country is, or I would hope the majority of the rest of the country, I should say, is kind of alarmed and upset by this, they should be. Most people of color who've been in the education business and who have been around and been Americans for over 50 years. This is not a shocker to us. It's disappointing, but we are not surprised.
Okay. Yeah. And, you know, it's unfortunate that, you know, all of you folks, you know, have had to deal with that. You know, and I look at it this way. It's not just African-Americans, though.
No.
Okay. No. I mean, I ran into this with the Latino communities when I lived in Texas.
Yes.
And, you know, I also, you know, my wife is foreign born, and she, you know, her communities that she's, you know, she was very strong in the community there and where we lived in Central Texas. And now here where we are, I don't see much of it here, but in Texas, I noticed it.
Sure.
That there was a lot of diversity down there in the schools, because you weren't of a certain demographic. I'm like, you know, what is with all of that? That's crazy.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
No, it's like I said, it's one of those things now where, as an educator, I would advise communities and schools to be aware of this. And now that you know, I mean, you can Google this. Now that you know that DEI programs are disappearing or shrinking or changing shape in a variety of not only school systems, but corporations in corporate America and in public education. You see that happening. So now that you know that, you have to be about the business of being creative, as you know, as you were talking about, doing some workarounds, community-based workarounds, individual school system workarounds, to make sure that you are maintaining as much of the original intent of DEI as possible.
Yeah. And that's the thing. The federal government, it hasn't changed their standards at all. So if you want that funding, you've got to maintain the standards. So it's like one hand is doing the other one, and then on the other hand, you got to satisfy the other one. It's like, it's almost like catch 22, you know.
It is.
You can't really win too well. You got to keep it going. The schools need the funding, period. And that's the way it is.
I can tell you from my experience, one of the things that I was blessed to be a part of when I was an assistant principal in Central Virginia, many, many years ago, I was an assistant principal at Orange County High School. Well, it wasn't many, many years ago. It was 2011 to 2018. My wife, who was also a principal at the time, she's now also a retired principal. She was an elementary principal. And we were talking about trying to shrink the achievement gap, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things she brought up to this then superintendent was, well, what are we doing for African-American boys? Because we saw in our data that was the group that was, I won't say struggling the most, but that was the group that was having the most difficulty with, in terms of a lot of academic markers.
Mm-hmm.
And so our superintendent, you know, said, well, that's a good question. What are we going to do about it? And one thing, you know, as an educator, whenever you bring up something, be aware of that, because you'll usually be the one in charge of this task force to make it happen.
Yeah.
That's how it's assigned.
It's like that in the military too.
Yes, yes, yes. And so luckily, I, along with two other African-American administrators in the system, two other male African-American administrators in the system, worked with central office, and we were able to get in touch with the scholars Donna Ford and Gilman Whiting out of Vanderbilt University, and they had created a program for identifying African-American boys and encouraging them to join higher level classes, AP classes, dual enrollment classes, honors classes, and the like. And so we worked with them to create what was called the Orange County Academic Scholars Institute. And what we did was we identified those African-American male students that were doing relatively well academically, but for whatever reason were not being recommended for the honors classes, the AP classes, the dual enrollment classes. And we decided to make a concerted effort to make sure that we pushed them in the direction to make that happen. But we realized that would have to be funded, and funding was tight even then. We think funding is tight now, funding was tighter even then. So what we did was, here's an example of a community workaround. We created a committee and we reached out to all of the local African-American churches and told them what we were trying to do. had asked for their support, and we were able to get donations from churches, from parishioners, local businesses, and they were so excited that we were making this effort that they really, really supported us, and they allowed us to secure the funds to be able to work with the University of Virginia, who allowed us to come for a 2-week program on their campus. They offered us classrooms. They offered us free lunches every day. And we were able to invite speakers in and some instructors from UVA, instructors of color in the sciences, the medicine, math, some athletes were there as well, music, all the humanities. And so our goal was to get a group of young men together. And it's not just enough when you say you're going to take a group and encourage them to enroll in harder classes. It's not just enough to do that. You have to be able to provide the support once they get in the classes academically so they can stay in the classes.
Yeah.
So we got started that program called the Academic Scholars Institute. And we taught about the 9 constructs of a scholar. And we really pushed that whole idea to them. And in doing so, over the years, because the program continued, we were able to create a large group of African-American males who were graduating from the high school and going to four-year colleges, places like one went to Harvard, one went to University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Several of them went to the Virginia schools, the Virginia colleges. And we were just very, very excited about that opportunity working with the young people. And I was blessed to be able to do that for the 6 years that I was an assistant principal in Orange County High School. And then when I left to become principal of Cumberland High School, the program still went on, which I was very glad to hear. When people leave, the ball gets dropped. But because of the fantastic educators I had working alongside me, gentlemen like Walter Bryant and gentlemen like Jesse Magruder, they carried the torch, and it's still going strong today. I just did a video for them recently talking about the history of the program. And so I'm here to say that it can be done. DEI is one of those things where it was a gift when we got it, and we were glad to get it. But if we are students of American history, if we're students of how the world works, we know it could be taken away at any time. And so the goal is, what are you doing in the meantime to create an infrastructure, an independent infrastructure and network, so that these things can still happen? And so when I think about that, and I still think of the young men that I'm in touch with today that still talk to me, who are some of them who are now college students going for their master's degree. Some of them are now in the world of work and running businesses and doing great things like that. I know that our work was not in vain.
That's good. That's good. So if we get into the next question, so do you see African-American students have more issues getting into college and university with all this divisiveness around DEI or lack of it in certain parts of the country? I mean, my daughter told me that they don't yet down there where she's at, but I've been hearing some rumors that it's affecting some states out west.
I'm sure it's affecting places everywhere. It's just one of those things that we have to really work on trying to create an atmosphere independent of the government to get the community to understand the importance of it and let them know that we don't have to wait for programs to be given to us. We can create things on our own.
Okay. Well, that's good, because I'm hoping that there's people out there across the country that are listening to this and then they can get this bug in their brain saying, hey, you know what? The government's not going to help us, do it for ourselves.
Yes. And there are ways that you can do that. Like I said, contact the local churches, contact the civic groups, local NAACPs. All of those groups worked with us to make our program happen. And then we were blessed to have the University of Virginia, helping us, behind that. And of course, a lot of the African-American administrators from the University of Virginia were key in putting that program together for us. So once we created a program, we had a place to take the kids. It's not just enough to tell the kids, go for higher classes, continue and increase your academic rigor. We want to show them the places they can go and the type of people they can associate with if they do that, if they take that route.
Yeah. I mean, you've got to be able to show somebody what the end result could look like if you go for it, not right. just hold a carrot out there and say, yep, here it is. You know, no, you got to give more than that. So that leads, you know, into the next one. There have been some small things here and there, but did you notice an overall uptick in safety issues with minorities and campuses around the country?
Well, I mean, you mean in terms of their safety or?
Yeah. Student safety.
I don't think it's any more of an uptick than overall than it has been in the past. I mean, right now the threat is not physical. The threat is institutional.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what we need to concentrate on. You know, there were fewer safeguards against the violation of the safety of students of color, you know, in the 60s, 70s, and 80s than there are now. And of course, yeah. with the attention that's being paid to, how minorities are being treated, even in this atmosphere of the scaling back of DEI, I can't say that I've noticed an uptick in terms of safety issues for students of color. My things I'm seeing are based more in terms of institutional differences and a lack of understanding and a lack of empathy and a less of a desire to actually help these young people achieve the goals they want to achieve.
Yeah. I mean, part of the reason I asked that question is because, like I said, I used to live in Texas, Central Texas, and I used to live not far from the University of Texas. And, you know, during the pandemic year and a little bit afterwards, because, I mean, even though I had moved to Virginia at the end of 2020, I still had a lot of friends down there and kept my ear to the ground. And so, yes, you know, the University of Texas did have an uptick in stuff like that. And minorities in general, whether they were Latino or African Americans, there was a higher statistic in a couple of years afterwards, which, you know, has dwindled, which is good, you know, as far as it goes. But I've read news stories, let's put it that way, about places, Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana, which have always had problems.
Right.
But it seems like here lately, especially in the last couple of months or so, they seem to be a little more emboldened to do things than they used to. And like you said, it may be just kind of part of a short curve and it may die down back again. Texas has, you know, dealt with their issues. You know, there's other states out there that are also having issues, Idaho being one of them. But Idaho is just kind of an outlier state anyway. So,
right. I mean, I don't know if they're any more or less emboldened than they've ever been. I think sometimes now with the advent of social media and access to what's going on, you can see more of it. I'm not sure. I mean, of course, there very well may be a growth in terms of these things happening. But when we talk about, you know, who's emboldened to do what, there's certain groups that have always felt emboldened to do certain things. It's just that, you know, that it's harder to go under the radar now. With a 24/7 coverage with news channels and social media, and everybody's carrying a camera around in their back pocket. So if you want to act up, you will be caught.
Yeah. So you will be caught. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it goes back to what you were saying earlier. Being caught is one thing. And whether the authorities, whether it be campus or the local state government, or what have you, whether they do anything about it is the other part of it.
There you go. There you go.
It's all well and good to put it up on YouTube and TikTok. But if nobody does anything about it, then, you know, it just went for naught.
And the beauty, there's always negative parts to everything. But one of the great parts, I think, of social media is it shines a light on these things. So now when people say, well, we didn't know or we weren't aware of this. Sure, you were. It's a viral tape. So you can't say on the local level that you didn't know. And so if you don't do anything, it's clear that your intentions were not to do anything rather than, you know, it's actual intention as opposed to ignorance.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. Well, that's a good thing too. I'm not a big fan of social media, but it does have its uses in sometimes.
Yes, indeed.
So let's go back into, let's get out of the college level. Let's talk about primary schools. Here in America, they call them elementary, junior high, and high school. So I've seen some news articles of late talking about school lunch programs being eliminated. Right. Of course, during 2020, they initiated free lunches for students across the board. And of course, that money went away here recently. And I read a bunch of stories last year when it disappeared that a lot of schools were saying, well, all right, no more federal money. We're not paying for it either. And now students were starting to go back to being hungry again. Of course, it's always been a thing. Before the government was funding these things, there were a lot of students that were going hungry. And unfortunately, but the big thing is, any child, I don't care where he comes from, if he goes to school hungry, he's not going to be studying too much because he's listening to his empty tummy.
That's true.
Okay.
That's true.
And that's, but if you listen to the news stories, and I admit they're all biased in one way or the other, some are left, some are right, and then very rarely you see something in the middle.
Yeah, news isn't news anymore. News is pretty much all opinion now.
Yeah, it's all opinion now.
It's informed opinion, but it's still opinion.
Yeah. Be honest with you, I call it clickbait these days. Sure. Because that's exactly how these stories come out. They generate a headline that's designed to be clickbait so people will read it, and then maybe they'll read the story underneath it. And that's unfortunate the way the news has gone. But with that, like I said, I read some stories where after the federal government funding disappeared, the states backed off and said, oh, we're not paying for that either. And now we got more hungry kids. So, have you seen this, in the last, maybe since last summer, any kind of an uptick in this?
As an educator in Virginia, I have not seen this. I can tell you, I'm glad about that, especially in the districts where I've worked. We had breakfast for the kid, any kid that wanted it every morning, and lunch for any child that wanted it during lunch period. During the actual school day, we were feeding kids as best we could in terms of what we were allowed to do. So even during the pandemic, when we had hybrid schedules in certain school systems, and when some kids would go on A days and B days, to maintain the social distancing, we even had situations where when kids weren't in school, they could come to local stops throughout the county and pick up bag lunches supplied by the school systems. So in the places that I've worked, especially and recently, most of the places I've worked have been small rural communities. They tend to band together and look out for each other and make things happen, make ways out of no way, I can imagine it's happened throughout in the country, but in the places where I've worked, I have not seen that. I've seen people making a lot of effort to make sure all the kids are fed as best they can whenever they need it.
Well, that's good, because that tells me that the news stories that are going out there are just looking for, something to raise eyebrows and get somebody's attention.
That's one state, though. Remember, that's one state. So I can't speak for Texas, Florida, Connecticut, Arizona. I can just say, in terms of Virginia, and especially in my small corner of Virginia, that has not been an issue.
Right. And be honest with you, I haven't read any stories about Virginia either. And that's a good thing. Yes. And the news stories were coming from places like Missouri, Tennessee, Alabama, Mississippi, and stuff like that, where they always had a problem even before the pandemic.
Right.
When I was a kid growing up, I grew up in a very, very rural community, and my folks were extremely poor. So my brother and I did bag lunches because we couldn't afford to pay for school lunches.
There you go.
So that was just how that was. Living on a farm, we had plenty of food. We just had to grow it.
Right. Absolutely.
Yeah. It's not a question of being hungry. But the other part of it, I guess, from looking at it from a child's perspective, being a brown bagger was never a good thing because you had kids picking on you because you were brown bagging your lunch in the school cafeteria.
Well, it's all a matter of perception. It's all a matter of, it's all relative, because you might ask some kids today, they would rather get the food from home than the food they're getting from the cafeterias.
Oh, yeah.
It all depends on, you know, on what's being cooked, how it's being cooked, things of that nature. I noticed when I also spent some time during the course of my career as a food services director. And I saw that change when it went from food actually being cooked to food being heated.
Oh.
You know, and so and I can tell you the kids, you know, they love the cooked food.
Oh yeah, yeah.
That sometimes the heated food is a whole other story in terms of palate and taste and all of that. So
right. Yeah. You know, I've heard some kids tell me, yeah, kid, you know, school lunches are almost like prison food. I'm like, how do you know about prison food?
Right. There you go.
But the fact that they're comparing it to that was an eye opener. But yeah, you're right. Maybe I agree that the perspective on, you know, bringing food, you know, it's one thing kids used to love, the little kids, you know, first, second, kindergarten, first, second, third graders, even coming in with their fancy lunch boxes and no, look at me, I got this kind of thing. That was way better than getting a lunch off the trays and stuff like that. And
yes,
and that thing. But then as the kids got older, you know, middle school and that kind of stuff, the dynamics changed.
Well, because no one wanted to be viewed as the person whose mommy prepared their lunch for them.
Oh yeah.
And so, oh, your mommy made you a lunchbox. They didn't want to get teased like that. So it was easier to go through the line, even though they may not have liked the food as much as, you know, what in terms of what mom was cooking. So it's all about perception, social acceptance, a lot of these things when it comes to school lunches. So.
Yeah, and then, you know what?
A teacher, you just kind of just let things happen and watch how it goes. If mom wants to make the lunch, great. But if there's nobody making lunch at home, we got lunch for you if you want it.
Right. And you know, it's funny how kids are, no matter what happens with the politics and everything else that's going on around them, it's always about that social perception amongst their own.
Always. Which is part of the reason, going back to some of your original questions, part of the reason, you know, some of these programs with regards to DEI are challenging to implement. Mm-hmm. I know one of the things that was a challenge to us when we implemented it in Orange County was we had some students that were under the mindset that academic achievement and doing well in school and being in honors course and advanced courses, that's what the white kids do. We're not really with all that. We don't want to do that. That's for the white kids. And so you had to kind of fight that own self-perception. And these were kids of color who had all the skills, all the tools to compete with anybody in any of those classes, but they were under the impression that they were not going to be treated as well, or they were going to be viewed as a token or an anomaly or what have you. And so some of them just said, well, I'd rather not even be in the class and have to deal with all of that. But we had to, you know, work hard to kind of help them understand when you're going out into the bigger world, you're going to have to deal with all kinds of people and deal with all kinds of perceptions about you. And your job is to shatter those perceptions or just be the best person you can be. And when they see the consistency of the work that you do time and time again, they'll learn for themselves, oh, this young man is not to be played with. He should be here just as much as I should be here. He has every right to be in this classroom with me.
Yeah, and it's unfortunate too, but you know, and it goes back to my own life. I ran into that when I was growing up. Now, we didn't have any people of color in my school, okay? But that doesn't mean that there wasn't a lot of bias and prejudice.
Sure. Okay?
So, and it was split pretty much, except for my family. We were the outsiders a lot. But the big thing about it, where I grew up, you had what we called the American kids, okay? They're from British ancestry, Swedish ancestry, and stuff like that. What we called, you know, what we call the European ancestry kids. And then it were the French Canadians. And it was like night and day between the two groups. And, you know, my family being Irish, we were right in the middle. We got picked on by both sides.
okay.
Yeah. But the big thing was that no matter where you go, okay, it's not the color of your skin so much. It's about perception. It's the perception that what I think parents do pass on to their children, and the kids hear it at home and they take it to school with them. And, you know, that's the way it is until educators like yourself can convince them otherwise. And sometimes that's a pretty hard wrench.
It's a tough thing. But, you know, one thing that I've always loved about the different levels of education, when kids are in elementary school, when they're in pre-K or when they're in Head Start, or those younger programs for the babies, I call them the babies. Mm-hmm. When they're in those programs, they really don't see color. They really don't.
Yeah.
That's just little Billy or Jimmy and Susie that's in my class, and I play with them and they're fun and all of that.
Right.
Then something happens as they get older, as they start having more conversations with their parents about these things. And then you see the changes or the subtle tribalism start to occur in terms of separation of groups, whether it be religious, you know, by religion or by race or by, you know, neighborhood, what have you. And so that's the thing that we really need to concentrate on. I would tell my students, you know, those who want to live in a colorblind society, living in a colorblind society is not what it's about. It's not.
Nah.
It's about seeing the differences and embracing the differences.
Yep.
You know, because sometimes we use that colorblind rhetoric as an excuse to not pay attention to the particular situations and struggles that a particular group has. It's just easier to say, well, I don't see color. Well, the only people who don't see color, Ray Charles doesn't see color, Stevie Wonder doesn't see color, but if you got eyes that work, you see color. Let's stop playing
that. That's right. Yeah, you can't ignore it. I'm sorry. Just the way it is. So the big, you know, so this kind of goes back to, you know, kind of a, I want to say the year 2020 was more or less a demarcation point for the world and the United States in particular. A lot of things changed because they shut everything down. But so since then, all right, do you feel like that kids in primary schools are falling behind academically now compared to, you know, earlier generations?
I don't know about earlier generations. I can tell you in terms of recent history, yes, I think they're starting off behind. They're falling behind because those 2019 through 2021, those years were interrupted academically. They were really kind of a tough time on everybody. And this is what we knew as educators. We knew there would be a learning gap. We knew that once the pandemic was over or declared over, we were going to spend a lot of time doing catch up. I don't think many of us realized how much catch up it was going to be.
Hmm.
But we knew that. And so that's just part of where we are right now. We could lament that and say, oh, this pandemic did so much to destroy public education or to weaken people's motivations, especially students, in terms of where they are academically. You could sit there and, you know, lament about that all day. But in the end of the day, what are we going to do about it now? Okay, so COVID is over, supposedly. Yeah. So now what are we going to do about it now? How are we going to do the best we can to get them back to where they need to be? And that's what the focus is right now. You see a growth in problems in terms of behavior of students and social emotional issues. A lot of that is because of the separation and isolation that these students probably felt for the prior 2 years. You know, for a whole 2 years in a lot of districts and systems, the daily structure of everyday education was taken away from these young people.
Yeah.
You know, and so they kind of had to fend for themselves, especially in those situations where you were doing distance learning from home.
Right.
And teachers were doing Google Meet classrooms and sending packets home. And you had to, you know, really, if you were a parent, you had to really be involved to make sure that your child was keeping up as much as he or she could during those times. And that was a strain on everybody. That was a strain on parents. That was a strain on kids, teachers, everyone. So, you know, as an educator, I remember having discussions where we even said, you know, we talked about, so how are we going to deal with the learning loss after this finally subsides? Because we saw it coming and we knew that it was going to be an issue. And so no one should be surprised that this has happened. We should be, you know, about the business of trying to change things for the better. But, you know, all these folks who are clutching their pearls out here say, I didn't think these kids would be like this. You didn't? Because here's what I want to tell educators, and I get in trouble sometimes. I can say it now as a retired educator. I get in trouble sometimes when I say this to educators, especially this younger group of very fine educators, I add, that are coming into the process now. They're young, they're innovative, they want to help these kids, and I understand and I love it about them. But I see so many of them, especially on social media, lamenting the fact that the kids can't read on grade level, lamenting the fact that the behaviors are so egregious in terms of what's happening in the classrooms. Let me tell you something. I tell young people all the time, the behaviors may be more intense now, but COVID simply brought to the surface what has been there for a very, very long time.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, back in the 90s when I first started teaching, I mean, you know, I've been breaking up fights since 1997. That's not new. Before COVID was even a thing, I had a student try to swing on me. Lucky for him, it didn't connect because it would have been a bad situation for him. But it happened. Before COVID was even a thing, I had a middle school student threaten to kick me in the groin. And those weren't the words he used.
Right.
You know, before COVID was even a thing, I could tell you stories about inappropriate behavior and things that kids were doing in terms of rudeness and language and all kinds of things. So these things have been there for a while. Once again, now when you have social media and you have cameras, a lot of the things that people just talked about and just heard about is now brought to you on a daily basis.
Yeah.
And so you begin to think things are, you know, are really, really horrendous. And in some cases, they are more difficult. But a lot of these things have always been around, you know, and teachers have been talking about this in faculty rooms and at private functions for decades now.
Yeah.
And so it's just a matter of continuing the fight to provide structure for the students, to let them know that we care about you, we want you to learn, but you know, you're going to behave towards each other and towards us in a certain way. We're going to have a civilized society. And that's just the constant struggle and that teachers have gone through. Like I said, I would agree that it's probably more intense and more frequent now. But these behaviors are not new.
No.
They've been around for literally for decades. And for those new teachers who are alarmed at the fact that new and old teachers, new and veterans, who are alarmed at the fact that a lot of the students are not reading on grade level. Well, this is a Googleable fact I'm about to give you. 54% of all Americans, regardless of race, creed, color, or age, 54% of all Americans read on the sixth grade level or lower.
Yeah, I can believe it.
So the kids can't read because America doesn't value reading.
Yeah.
That's the only conclusion I can draw. I've been teaching long to remember when reading wasn't rolled into the language arts curriculum, reading was its own class.
Yeah.
You had math, science, history, English, and reading.
I remember that when I went to high school.
Right. So it wasn't just, oh, we'll just cover the reading in English. When they're reading the novels, we'll deal with the reading skills. No, that's you can't do that. You have to have a supplement there where you're teaching the kids about decoding words and interpreting words and all of those things. And so they use those skills when they're in their English class to then read the classics and the literature and have the type of literary discussions that you want the kids to have at that level. But, you know, you're trying to teach kids Shakespeare and the kid is still trying to, you know, put together words. It's a recipe
for disaster. Work. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, I admit I struggled with English, you know, as a kid. I come from a dual language house, and so English was not my first language.
Right.
And, you know, so I struggled, but I made it. You know, I survived. And like you said, back in the old days, and I remember this when I went to high school, we had a specific reading class where you were taught to read and you were given books to read and so on, and you had to do a certain amount for homework assignments and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And you were encouraged to go to the library and do things and this and that. But, you know, I graduated decades ago. So it's one of those deals where I haven't really tracked what's been going on. So it's interesting to hear you say that, well, those things have faded away. That's why a lot of the kids are growing up not learning how to, you know, read English anymore.
And the pendulum swung back and forth. You know, there were many years, especially when I was a young person, I remember, we taught phonics in school. But then we moved from phonics to quote unquote whole language. That kind of put young people at a disadvantage over the course of several years. But it has to, reading is an art and a science. It really is. And the mastery of it, you have to go back to the digraphs and the phonemes and the consonant blends and the long vowel and the short vowel. And then you graduate to the main idea, supporting detail, the comprehension questions, the essay writing, the vocabulary development. All of that has to come together over the course of years. And it has to be at a level of consistency where a child can really grow into it and through it. And so then you have that with the combination of how things have changed, even how young people communicate with each other. You notice with the texting, you'll see things like how the letter R, the letter U, doing. And we think that's kind of silly and we think it's, you know, trivial. But if that's how a child grows up writing, you should not be surprised when you get a paper from the child and you're saying, what is this gobbledygook? What's going on here? You know, and so these are all things we have to consider. It's all around us, and we have to be vigilant about it. So that I would say to any teacher going into education right now, fear not. It is still one of the most noble of professions. But there are some things that are required of teachers nowadays that probably shouldn't be required of teachers, and that's another discussion for another show. But in the meantime, between time, spend less time being alarmed by what the kids can't do and more time trying to figure out how we can get them to where we need to be. And know that we won't get everyone to everywhere we want them to be. But if we can get everybody just to grow, if we can get everybody just to grow on a yearly basis, we have done a yeoman's job. That's our job.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. You know, I remember, you know, now that I think about it, and I mean, I haven't thought about this probably ever. I kind of remember going in the first and second grade now where we had learning to read classes, and they did the phonetics and they taught you how to say the vowels and the consonants and all those kind of things. I didn't realize that they had done away with all of that.
And so a lot of it's coming back now because we realize it needs to. But yeah, for a while, that wasn't happening at the same level of intensity that happened when we were coming up. I'll even go to the media on this one. As a person who was born in 1969 and grew up as a child of the 70s and the 80s, early 80s to some extent, I remember on Saturday, after school, when it came to television, you were going to school just as much as you were when you were in school. Think about the shows they had on public television back then. They had Sesame Street. So a lot of kids knew their alphabets and they could count to 10 before they even set foot on a kindergarten classroom campus.
Yeah, that's how my kids were.
Right. Then you had Schoolhouse Rock. A lot of kids knew about the parts of speech, nouns, hey, nouns, person, place, or thing, verb, that's what's happening, lolly, 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 get your adverbs here, all that good stuff. They knew a lot of the parts of speech before they even got to school. I remember when I was in elementary school, I knew about bills being signed into law. I'm just a bill. Yes, I'm only a bill. And if they vote for me on Capitol Hill, those types of shows, and those things stick with you. We have gotten away from that. Now, if you want to see that, you have to purchase it. You have to buy it and put on a tape and put on a continuous loop for your kids. We have the Captain Kangaroos, the Electric Company, Zoom, You know, a lot of different programs. Villa Alegre. I learned about Spanish. I didn't know Spanish, but you had that show Villa Alegre where they would say the first half of the show, they do it entirely in Spanish. And the second half of the show, they do the same exact show, but entirely in English. So by the time you watched it, this word means that, and this word means this. Okay.
Yeah. My youngest son grew up like that.
Yeah. The television was a teacher when I was a little child. Now the television is purely a babysitter.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the types of imagery and the types of knowledge that used to be able to, you could extract from television as a youngster, you can't do that anymore. So there's so many different variables that brought us to where we are.
Wow. So I'm going to skip over question six here because we pretty much already talked about it. But I will bring this out on the last thing I want to ask you. So at this point, you know, do you have any really, really good solutions out there, or have you heard of any really good solutions beyond what you've already mentioned for, you know, making schools more equal between the kids? I mean, like you talked about, it's not a question of colorblind. It's about acceptance. Okay. Right. So, I mean, do you think maybe schools, other than grassroots in the communities, I mean, is there anything else that you can tell us that, bring more equality back to the schools?
I think one of the things that we need to do as teachers is to stop assuming that just because we work with children on a daily basis and we like children and we want to see them learn and grow, we can't just assume this just because that's how we live our lives, that we have no biases. There are biases in all of us.
Yeah.
And so how are we going to honestly address those biases in a way that helps us become better teachers to our students? You know, for example, when it comes to, I remember when it comes to sometimes discipline, even as disciplining students, well, you know, some students may communicate with each other in different ways and in different tones. And that might be interpreted by one group of teachers as disrespect. I'd be interpreted by another group of teachers as, oh, that's just kids kidding around. But depending on your knowledge of the people you're teaching and your own personal background, that affects things like how you discipline kids. That affects things like how you teach kids. Maybe some of the preconceived notions you have about young men and women in your classrooms are based upon what you grew up around. So. Yeah. We have to be very, very diligent in our efforts to make sure when we talk about equity that we are, as teachers, understanding of cultures. For example, and that's not just white teachers and students of color. That's in every situation. When I first started teaching in rural areas, right? So I came to Central Virginia from teaching in Washington, D.C. at Prince George's County, Maryland, which were two heavily black populated areas. So when I'm coming to rural Central Virginia, you know, I need to figure out how to reach our young people. So I began to step out of my character or step out of my comfort zone. And I began to learn about musicians like Toby Keith and Garth Brooks and some of the, and learn about how, when hunting season was, and understand that maybe my classes weren't going to be as full on certain days because that's when hunting season begins. And you have to, you know, kind of immerse yourself in what's going on around you and then use that to inform how you impart knowledge to your young people. Because when I started making those connections, when I started using popular songs, popular country songs, as a way to teach similes and metaphors, then my kids were like, they were excited, number one, because I had taken the time to learn about something that they liked. And then I was able to convert that to something that would help them in terms of their knowledge about the subject I was teaching. They even liked that even more. And so everybody kind of has to be willing to do that. And most times when kids see that you're willing to meet them halfway with regards to those things, you will have levels of success. And I'm not saying everybody has to do it. I'm not saying every teacher must be an entertainer. But here's the thing. It is not 1974. It is not 1984. It is not 1994. It is 2024. There are a lot of things that you're competing with now to gain the attention of these young people. So yeah. You better work hard to find a way to reach them, whatever way that takes. If you are, you know, when I was in the classroom, I was also a high school football coach. So I had no problem with athletes because the athletes knew they had to come through Mr. Williams' English class in order to be able to play on Friday night. So if that paper was due, you better have it ready. Because I'm only going to hear from Mr. Williams, the English teacher. You're going to hear from Mr. Williams, the football coach. What's going on here? What's happening here?
Right.
Why isn't the work done? So you find ways to connect to them and areas that they're interested in and find levels of commonality. And in many of those cases, you'll find that you'll have success with students. It's not a, you know, a panacea. It's not a be-all, end-all. Because I know a lot of people get mad when folks say build relationships with kids. You know, what does that even mean? It just means knowing what your students like, are accustomed to, what gets them excited, and try to find ways to get what gets them excited. Try to find ways to get them excited, using that to get them excited about learning. If you can do that in some form or another, you'll have some level of success. I really do believe that.
Yeah, I mean, I followed that principle somewhat as an NCO in the military. You know, I had diverse group of guys come to work for me. And in order for me to get them to be productive, I kind of had to get in their heads a little bit and find out where they came from. How are they thinking this? And kind of mold tools to say, all right, what can I do to get you interested in what your job is supposed to be?
That's right.
I mean, everybody knows, you know, just to use a little bit of military background, everybody knows a guard duty stinks. Okay. Nobody likes it. I never liked it. They don't like it. But, you know, I used to just tell them, hey, I'm sorry, but this is just how it is. You're in the military now. This is just a part of what we have to do. Yeah. Okay. I agree with it. It stinks. But as long as I admitted to them that I say it is really bad, they were okay with, well, if sergeant says it's bad, then we just suck it up and move on. You know,
right.
Which, you know, what we have to do.
When I was even as a leader, you know, when it comes to being an administrator with teachers, you know, you have to let them know that I'm not asking you to do anything that I haven't done or am willing to do.
Right.
You know, and understand, yes, this part of the job is not fun and we'd rather not have to do it. But in order to achieve the other part of the success we want, sometimes we have to do those things. And, you know, when you do those things, I want to do everything I can to recognize you and reward you for the extra effort you're putting forth, because I know you didn't have to do it. And I knew you were doing it surely for the love of the children and surely for the ideal of making sure that our children grow academically and socially. And we appreciate you for that. But it's all about just continuing to find ways to motivate people, find a way that gets people turned on, gets them motivated, and find a way to use that to your advantage. That's a life strategy. That's not just a teacher strategy or a military strategy. That's a life strategy. So,
yeah. Well, that's good to know. So, I mean, have you got anything else that you want to add to all of this?
Well, I want to tell everybody that if you want to hear more from me and learn more about what I'm doing in terms of my public speaking engagements and the vocabulary development workshops I'm doing with young people and all the things I'm trying to do post in building career, check out www.eugenewilliamsjr.com. You can also see me on the Instagram at EUGWILLJR. And you can also find me on TikTok at Eugene Williams Jr. Also want to let you know that I have, if you check out in Google, I've written several books. There's a book that I've written called It's a Reading Thing, Help Your Child Understand. That's for parents. Another book that I've written called Grounded in the Word. And that's a book where we took the 500 most commonly found SAT words and verbal vocabulary words and cross-referenced them with the vocabulary found in the King James Version of the Bible. So kids can learn about the word while learning with the meaning of words. And so just Google me. I'm around, Eugene Williams Jr. You can see all the things that I'm doing and all the things I want to continue to do for the young people of our country, of all races.
Well, that's good. That's real good. Well, I appreciate you coming on the show today. Like I said, my my whole purpose of this show was to showcase DEI in good or bad light, however it is. The big thing for me was I was surprised when I talked to my daughter, you know, she was saying the workarounds, because to be honest with you, I expect her to tell me that all fell apart and they were in chaos down there and all kinds of stuff. When she told me, no, it really wasn't. I was actually, frankly, surprised. You're telling me the same thing.
It never falls apart if it's something that the leadership in your school, your university, your school system has decided that's what we want to achieve. The whole idea of the funding for DEI was great because it gave us the money and the resources to even go further with it. But if you know, equity and inclusion and diversity is something that's close to the heart of your leadership in any organization, you can always find ways to make that a priority, even without government funding, if you really want to.
If you really want to. Okay, that's the key word. Okay. Well, very good. Well, sir, I appreciate you coming on the show. I'm going to close it out right now with a bit of a message here. The show comes out middle of the week, and I appreciate everybody will come in here and tune in and see what we got for you. All right. Very good. Thank you.
Thank you.
I want to thank Mr. Eugene Williams for being here on the show today and to remind you to stay tuned. I've got my veterans public service announcement here at the tail end, and to invite you to come back for next week's show when I'll have something probably totally different for you. So I hope you'll come back next week and tune in. Thank you for showing up. Sláinte. I want to take a minute to tell any veterans out there who may be watching or listening to this show, or a dependent who may be living with a veteran who may be struggling, but they don't want to reach out because of the stigma attached. I will tell you that I have been there, and I struggled for a few years before I was more or less forced into seeking help from a local veterans center. It changed my life. Not before I lost another family, but at least I didn't end up on the street or in jail, which I came close to. Look at the posters I have showing and take down the numbers shown. 988, then press 1. Text 838-255. Or go to veteranscrisisline.net/chat to talk to someone. It's all confidential, and they're open 24/7. Whatever's going on with you, they can help. I know that the counselors I reached out to gave me my life back. Someone here can do the same for you or your loved one. Help with just one phone call, text, or chat away. If someone needs help, don't hesitate any longer. Make the call that could save someone's life. Thank you for listening to the show today. I hope you enjoyed it, and you'll return again for another episode of the Village Oak Tree. Please share this podcast with your friends and relations. The more you share, the more we can convince enough people to make the world a better place to live in. This is Shauna K. I hope you'll continue to let me travel to your village to bring you some news from the world outside that might make you think a little after we part for the day. As I say goodbye this week, I wish to leave you with this Irish blessing as you go about your day. May the saddest day of your future be no worse than the happiest day of your past. Slán go fóill, which means goodbye for now in Irish.